From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Bowie, an 8-episode podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy. If you haven't listened to the first 5 episodes yet, I would recommend giving them a listen before proceeding with today's show. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. Now let's get back to the story of David Bowie. When we last left off, Bowie had briefly taken a break from his drug-fueled madness and realized that Tony DeFries, his manager, had swindled him out of the earnings he deserved. He knew that the only hand he held over his manager in the power struggle was his music. But at the moment, he had only 6 songs recorded months earlier. He returned to the studio and scrambled for ideas, finally deciding that he would do a cover of The Beatles' Across the Universe. Since he'd formed a friendship with John Lennon, not to mention their shared affinity for cocaine, Bowie asked John if he'd like to play on the track. John agreed to play on the song, and more material sprung from that chance jam session. Here's John discussing that fateful day.
I got to know David through Mick, really, although I'd met him once before. And next minute he says, "Hello, John, I'm doing the Across the Universe. Do you want to come on down?" So I said, "All right, you know, I live here." I popped down and I played rhythm. You know. And then he had this lick, you know, we'd finished Across the Universe and this guitarist had a lick, so we sort of wrote this song, you know, it was no big deal. We just sort of, boom, 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 you know, like that. It wasn't like sitting down to write a song, so we made this lick into a song is what happened. And that's how it happened, and there it is. You know.
That simple boom, 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 John described, will go on to be one of Bowie's biggest songs. Lennon and Bowie penned the lyrics for Fame, a song that explored the shared experiences the two stars dealt with as celebrities. Bowie also drew from his own frustrations with manager Tony DeFries, who had squandered away much of his earnings. Here's backup singer Robin Clark and guitarist Carlos Alomar discussing the song's inspiration.
It was actually written about his relationship with Tony DeFries.
It is the smoke screen that was created by DeFries. It's the illusion of fame.
Sort of like you think one thing is happening, but you turn around and your pockets are empty. You think you're a star, but then you find out that you can't pay your rent.
Lennon also gave Bowie advice on how to handle the DeFries situation.
When John found out what was happening, he said, "You need to take control of this."
On January 29th, 1975, David Bowie went to RCA Records to let them know he'd finally completed his next album, Young Americans. He then informed them that the master tapes were currently locked in a bank vault. With his next batch of songs held hostage, Bowie asked RCA if they would remain loyal to him if he cut ties with DeFries and Main Man. RCA assured him they were on his side and would later tell DeFries that they chose Bowie over him because, quote, he could sing. Bowie and DeFries would eventually come to an agreement, through negotiators of course, that in order for David to break his contract, DeVries would be entitled to 50% of the profits from all Bowie songs written between 1972 and 1982. Bad blood would remain between the two for the rest of their lives. In a twist of fate, DeVries would go on to lose $22 million in 2000 due to offshore tax evasion. Young Americans was released in March and would be the first album in 3 years to feature David Bowie on the cover and not Ziggy Stardust. Reviews for the album were overwhelmingly positive and remained Bowie's highest-selling album all the way up to his death. Legendary music journalist Lester Bangs wrote of Young Americans, "Bowie has changed the props. Last tour it was boxing gloves, skulls, and giant hands. This tour, it's black folks." Following the release of the album, Bowie moved to Los Angeles, where he crashed at the home of Deep Purple bassist Glenn Hughes, an arrangement that helped the financially struggling Bowie get back on his feet. Unfortunately, the LA lifestyle would send Bowie into an even deeper spiral, and Hughes was probably not the best choice of a living partner. Here's Hughes describing himself at that time.
Let me just say this. That in the 80s and the 70s and 80s, I was a very notorious drug addict. I was a very famous cocaine addict. Very famous. I don't say that to be arrogant, but I was one of the first rock stars to become, "Oh, Glenn Hughes, you're the cocaine addict, you know."
Hughes was in and out of the house throughout the year, having to take part in worldwide engagements with his band, leaving Bowie alone in the Beverly Hills mansion, paranoid and mentally unstable. The fact that Hughes lived four houses away from the La Bianca house, a notorious crime scene, caused Bowie to live in constant fear. Hughes tells of one story where he returned from a trip to discover that Bowie had hidden all of his knives under his bed. David also became obsessed with occult magic, feeling that he needed it in order to protect himself from evil forces. He believed that the demon of insanity was encoded in his DNA, the same madness that overcame his half-brother and aunts, and he felt that remaining in a constant cocaine psychosis could protect him from his inevitable insanity. He also quit songwriting in fear that the demons may emerge from his songs. He began drawing protective pentagrams throughout the house, and he made Hughes' home a sort of bunker for a terrified rock star. Here's David describing that period of his life.
But as drugs started to take a more severe hold on my life, the ability within your conscious mind to actually deliver yourself into two separate parts disappears, and the lines blur, and it's only this one formless mutant that's left behind. So it gets quite messy in there. It gets very messy in there. And by the mid-70s, I was so out of my gourd that really it was very impossible. It was all nigh on impossible for me to function in any rational way. So I didn't know I was playing characters at that time.
Los Angeles was one of the worst periods, I think, in my life, I think. I got into a lot of emotional and spiritual trouble there.
During this tumultuous period, Bowie would randomly call his wife Angie, who was in London, recounting his horrifying visions. It wouldn't be long before she flew to LA to check on her unhinged husband. One of Bowie's biggest fears at this time was inspired by a recent viewing of Rosemary's Baby. Bowie was convinced that witches were after his semen and wanted to use it to make a sacrifice to the devil.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
What are you talking about? Guy's eyes are normal. What have you done to him, you maniac?
Satan is his father, not Guy. He came up from hell and begat a son of mortal woman.
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Satan is his father, And his name is Adrian. He shall overthrow the mighty and lay waste their temples. He shall redeem the despised and wreak vengeance in the name of the burned and the tortured. Hail Adrian!
One of David's girlfriends on the side at that time, Cherry Vanilla, once said in an interview, he had this whole thing about these black girls who were trying to get him to impregnate them to make a devil baby. He asked me to get him a white witch to take the curse off of him. And I actually knew somebody in New York who claimed to be a white witch. Her name was Wally Elmlark. The woman known as the White Witch of New York had gained notoriety in the world of show business, befriending musicians like Mark Bolan and Jimi Hendrix, writing a column in the rock music magazine Circus, and even recording a spoken word album with King Crimson's Robert Fripp. Side note, to this day, the album has not been released, or else I'd be playing it right now. When not working her voodoo on celebrities, Elmlark taught classes in magic at the New York School of the Occult Arts and Sciences. Angie summoned Elmlark to Hugh's home, Bowie's foxhole at the time. Elmlark would exercise the swimming pool. Angie has said in interviews that the water began to bubble and smoke, wrote spells and incantations for David to recite, and remained on call for the neurotic star over the next few months. While David may have felt it was the witchcraft that helped him at that time, many believe that it was his involvement in the film The Man Who Fell to Earth that helped get him out of his own head.
It's a fantastic movie about power, space, time, and the visitor. David Bowie stars in The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Director Nicholas Rogue had originally thought actor Peter O'Toole would play the role of Newton, an alien who travels to Earth in order to try and save his planet. But after seeing Bowie's odd behavior in the documentary Cracked Actors, Rogue decided that David, with his strange mannerisms and look, would be a perfect fit for the part.
I think I thought of David Bowie when I first was trying to figure out who would be Mr. Newton. Someone who was inside society and yet awkward in it. Like, I don't know how to explain that, but awkward in it. Someone find themselves, someone who is at odds with society.
A new suit came in. It's not your color, it's blue.
No. During the making of the film, David got more than into the character of Mr. Newton. I think he put much more of himself than we'd possibly been able to get into the script.
I don't want to talk to anyone.
It was linked very much to his ideas in his music. And towards the end, I realized a big change had happened in his life.
Mommy, what's happened to you?
What's happened to me?
The film forced Bowie to clean up, not completely, mind you, and try to stay sober enough to perform daily. He also began work on music for the film's soundtrack, only to find out later that John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas had been commissioned for the movie's music. Once again, Bowie had to come up with a sudden change of plans on a project, this time around taking that music and releasing it as his next solo album, Station to Station. Much of the album was inspired by the filmmaking experience.
Scheme of things. You say we're growing, growing heart and soul. In this age of grand illusion, you walked into my life out of my dreams.
David was disappointed that his music wouldn't be used in the film. But in the end, he got the last laugh.
Nick Rogue does say that I took some of the character of Newton away with me from The Man Who Fell to Earth. The thing that I objectively remember taking with me was the wardrobe. I literally walked off with the clothes. And I used the same clothes on the Station to Station tour.
Station
Once filming had finished, Bowie returned to LA to record Station to Station, a six-song album that melded the soulful explorations of young Americans with his new musical obsession, the mechanical synth sounds of German bands like New and Kraftwerk, which you're listening to right now. His drug use may have lessened during filming, but back in the LA scene, he found himself back to his old habits. Fortunately, his muse had also returned. The result of these sessions is an album that some consider the first ever new wave album, combining the cold, calculated technological sounds of Germany with Bowie's more personal lyrics and melodic sensibilities. This amalgam of sounds is best seen on Golden Years, a song that would reach the top five in both England and America.
Don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere. Life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young. Come, there's my fever lost, that's all. Once I'm begging you, save a little soul.
To support the release of Station to Station, Bowie did several awkward TV appearances in the months that followed. The first would be on the Saturday morning dance show, Soul Train. A pale, sickly Bowie half-heartedly lip-syncing as a dance group of African-American women shook enthusiastically around him. This was followed by an appearance on the popular British show Russell Hardy Plus. The results make for what might be the most uncomfortable exchange in Bowie interview history, due in large part to Hardy's catty line of questioning.
Are you there, David Bowie?
Yes.
Last time we met on the air, you were sitting in this studio at this side, and you had a very elegant earring hanging from either your left or right ear. I can't remember. Do you remember that?
How are you, Russell? It's nice to see you.
Thank you. It's nice to see you, David. You look well. Now, you've got an announcement to make to us all, David, haven't you? You're changing your plans for the future, and you've got something up your sleeve for 1976.
Yes. I'm touring, but I'm coming back to England in May to play shows and look at you and look at England.
Well, you know,
and be there, be English.
Again.
Well, as always, but English in England.
You know, you haven't, your accent, your voice, your method of speech has not changed. You've been away for 2 years.
Yeah.
Does that mean you've been locked away somewhere?
Yes, I don't talk to anybody.
Do you know that the pop scene, though, at this end, the pop world has changed somewhat since you left?
No.
Have you heard of the Bay City Rollers?
Yes.
Well, you know that they're appealing to a kind of large, mass hysterical audience of young people who wave a lot of stuff around. Now, I wonder what kind of audience you're going to come back to face.
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm thinking in a kind of way. You may have to create a whole new scene for yourself.
No.
Well,
can't qualify that. I'll just come back and play my songs.
Now, for someone, you've been quoted as saying, David, that for someone who's not really a very good musician, you've made a lot of rumpus, a lot of noise. If you don't think you're a good musician, what are you looking for at this moment? What are you searching for?
Got
liquid,
it.
Liquid.
Treetop apple juice.
Is it good? Would you spit some across the satellite?
No.
Good.
Russell Hardy's belief that the Bay City Rollers were going to be the next big thing in music may have been a bit off base, but Bowie's measured response gives one the sense that he was a bit uncertain how to continue pushing the boundaries of music in an ever-changing landscape.
One, two, three, four.
As mentioned in the interview, Bowie and his band did a tour of both America and Europe in support of Station to Station. When the tour returned to Los Angeles, Bowie reconnected with Iggy Pop. Iggy had been pretty busy since last seeing David, getting arrested for shoplifting, possession of drugs, and sleeping in a stranger's garage. When the cops threatened to prosecute him, he committed himself to the Neuropsychiatric Institute, where he slowly got healthier, listening to James Brown's Sex Machine on repeat.
I like Sex Machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure you're born. Together,
right on, right on. When he finally was released from the hospital, Iggy quickly discovered that no one in Los Angeles wanted to deal with him, not even his drug dealers. Here's Iggy talking about how the only people that stood by him were his fans, his parents, and David Bowie.
They stuck with me when I was screwing up, when I was a jerk, you know, when I couldn't put out consistent product, when I couldn't talk three words in a row without falling down. When I wasn't doing good shows, they stuck with me, and some personal friends did too, especially David Bowie, and my mother and father, yeah, things like that, you know.
When the two reconnected at a posh hotel in Los Angeles, they shared stories of their struggles with drug addiction and mental instability. During this afternoon of bonding, Bowie played a tape of a groove he had created and asked Iggy if he would be interested in recording it. Iggy agreed.
He wrote the music to Nightclubbing. I got very excited and insisted I write a lyric to that. It wasn't at all rock, you know, and in that case, we used a drum machine. And at first he thought, well, gee, that's not, you know, that doesn't sound professional enough, you know. Yeah, it does. It's good enough for me. It's only Iggy fucking Pop. You know, it doesn't have to sound, you know. And we went for it. And it's that odd little Roland. It sounds cheap, but it sounds right for the song, you know. And so I tended to egg him on in that way, and he was only too willing to go farther and farther.
By the end of their meeting, Bowie told Iggy to pack his bags and return to the hotel the next day. He would be going on the rest of the tour, so the two could work on new music and also hold each other accountable in their efforts to get clean. In a way, Bowie saw Iggy as a little brother, and this was a chance to save him from his mental illness, something he was unable to do with his real-life brother, Terry.
Were you still on your mission to do something that other people weren't doing, Terry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and I had found my boy. Here was somebody very, very talented, and he wanted other outlets. There were certain things that I believe he was able to do with me that he chose not to do under his own flag.
Bowie came to see you, who was himself in quite a bad way.
He was jolly. I gather he was, in a sense, but never disorganized. He was always exhibited good spirits, and I saw him 24/7 for several days at a time often. And he was together, but yeah, there was stuff going on, you know.
When the tour ended in March of 1976 at Madison Square Garden, a new musical movement was taking shape in the form of punk rock. After the show, Bowie and Iggy went down to a new club called CBGB's to see the buzz band of the moment, the Ramones. The two rock stars of the old guard were nervous about entering the ravenous little club, but were surprised to see how openly the young punks embraced them, especially Iggy, who many saw as a huge influence on the movement. While other arena cock rockers like Robert Plant, Peter Frampton, and Rod Stewart had become enemy number one to punk rockers, Bowie got a pass from the rebellious youth due to his anti-masculine persona, his risk-taking as a songwriter, and of course, his connection to Iggy Pop. Tony James, the bass player from 70s punk band Generation X, said of David, "Bowie's affiliation with Iggy gave him a punk pass. He was 2 or 3 years ahead of everybody else in terms of spotting Iggy's talent." David was also a big fan of the musical revolution.
My understanding of punk rock is something that's happened in England, I think, really over the last couple of years. But what Jimmy was doing, I'd never seen Jimmy, really, but I'd heard some of his albums, and it sounded like, I don't know, nihilistic rock. My music is just basically, I look for things to tear apart, you know, and, oh, that's good to whip them.
With the tour finished, Bowie, Pop, Visconti, and Alomar headed to France to begin recording what would be Iggy's solo debut, The Idiot, an album that stood in stark contrast to his Stooges work, with its bare bones, synthesized atmospheres, and his brooding, Bowie-esque approach to singing. Well, what makes The Idiot an interesting album, beyond that it refused to capitalize off the punk rock movement, is how much it is influenced by David, a strange twist of fate considering how much Bowie admired Iggy's work just a few years earlier. Here's Iggy discussing how much David helped him relieve the pressure during this time.
Was there pressure at this time for you to make your work more commercial?
There would have been if I wasn't working with David Bowie. With him, not at all. None whatsoever. There was an incredible pressure to make good work, to make it good, and there was a self-imposed pressure to make it good also in terms of what should be commercial. Yeah. And that's why some of the songs became commercial 20, 30 years later.
During the Idiot sessions, Bowie also began trying to find what he called, quote, a new musical language for his next solo effort. At the time, he found himself enthralled by the music of Brian Eno on his album Another Green World, a minimalist album of ambient soundscapes that are able to enthrall you and keep your attention through the rhythms and melodies. With the support of RCA Records, Bowie was able to stamp out a deal where he'd record his next album over an extended period of time with Brian Eno and Tony Visconti. An unheard-of practice at a time when bands were on the clock to kick out another hit for summer consumption. Nowadays, bands will spend months and years holed up in isolation, but Bowie was one of the first to take on this exploratory approach. The threesome of Visconti, Eno, and Bowie spent several months in France, experimenting with sound, not concerned with trying to create a hit, instead trying to invent a new sound. The chateau, where they recorded, would be filled wall to wall with synthesizers. The creative process helped bring David back to his days in the arts lab, and the immersion in the project alongside two other musical prodigies helped provide him with a safe environment to explore. Here's Brian Eno discussing the process.
It was a kind of experiment in seeing what kinds of emotions pop music could cope with. You know, could it deal with despair and hysteria and idiot glee, as well as the things that pop had dealt with up until then?
Far away from the LA life of isolation and fear, Bowie began writing some of his most personal and revealing lyrics. Always Crashing in the Same Car recounts a night where in a coke fever, he repeatedly rammed the car of a drug dealer with his Mercedes because he felt he'd been ripped off. He would finish that night in a parking garage, driving in circles, disoriented by his surroundings. The album, entitled Low, would also feature a series of instrumental tracks on side B, many of which I've used on this show, including the podcast theme song, A New Career in a New Town. RCA Records was not very pleased when they were delivered an album that featured 5 synth experiments and 6 songs that sounded like they were transmitted from Mars. When Bowie refused to do more work on the album, the label responded with the release of a greatest hits album that May, to help fill the void of sales. Here's Visconti discussing the boundary-pushing project.
I get a phone call from David and Brian Eno, and they said, we're going to do an experimental album in France, in Chateau d'Hérouville in France. And they said, what can you bring to the table? We want to be far out, man. You know, we want to go as far as we can. I said, I've got a harmonizer. They go, great, what does it do? I said this spontaneously. I said, well, and I knew they would love this. I said, it fucks with the fabric of time. And at the other end of the phone, I heard them go, woo-wee! So it was great. It was absolutely great.
RCA Records would finally give in and release Low in January of 1977. And the reaction at the time by critics was one of confusion and antagonism. Today, however, Low is considered one of Bowie's most important works. In 2004, Pitchfork.com would place Low at number 1 on their list of the top 100 albums of the 1970s, writing, quote, Low isn't a sad album because it wields a fierce sense of adventure. Its core asks how to find a way out of darkness, then does so brilliantly. At his lowest point, Bowie forced himself to reimagine his creative process, retaining parts of his past while pushing forward. Low is an album about rebirth, which is why it still possesses the power to startle. Around the world, the kids who had been raised on the music of David Bowie were taking note of the new musical direction provided by their hero on Low. And in the next decade, they would use his vision to define what we today know as post-punk and new wave. David Bowie becomes an elder statesman on the next Year of the Bowie.